Welcome to the Belfast Men's Health Group podcast with Professor Robert West. Robert is a world authority on smoking and addiction and has been helping smokers quit for more than 30 years. Today, Robert's going to talk about a wee bit about smoking and addiction. But before that, Robert, thanks very much for agreeing to do our wee podcast. But tell us a wee bit about yourself, maybe a wee bit about your background or your influences. And how would you describe yourself, maybe?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Well, it's great to be here, and thanks for inviting me. I'm what's known as an emeritus professor of health psychology, which basically just means I've retired and they've stopped paying me, but I still carry on doing work. I've been at University College London for 16 or 17 years. Prior to that, I was at St. George's Hospital Medical School, where I was head of the psychology department there. And prior to that, at Royal Holloway and Bedford New College, as it was called in those days, basically sort of various places around London University. And yeah, my expertise is in psychology and in health psychology, and I spent loads of my time doing research into addiction and smoking, but also other things like traffic accidents. And then more recently, I've been working with my wife and colleague Susan Mickey on developing broader behavior change models.
Mm-hmm. And what was your childhood like growing up? Were your family interested in research, addictions? Was your mommy and daddy, are they any
yeah,
interest?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah. So my mum was a nurse. She worked in operating theatres. And I think it would be fair to say that she was a skeptic of pretty well everything I did. not hugely interested, I think it would be fair to say, or at least interested, but certainly not convinced. My dad and I used to have a great conversation. He was very interested in psychology. He was actually a partner in a firm called Price Waterhouse, as it was then, now Price Waterhouse or PwC, but he was really sort of intellectual, and he loved to think about things, and we had really good philosophical discussions about everything under the sun, and that probably was partly, I guess, where I got my interest in this from, but a sort of normal sort of middle-class upbringing, I guess. With a little bit of intellectual stimulation thrown in.
What about mentors or heroes? Any of those growing up? Maybe your daddy was one. Maybe.
My hero. Mm-hmm. Well, my heroes are guitarists.
Very good. Yeah.
If any of your listeners, if this means anything to any of your listeners, then good on them. My all-time hero is a guitarist called Robert Fripp, who is still the lead guitarist in a band called King Crimson, which some listeners may have heard of, progressive rock band. But lots of other guitarists. But intellectually and academically, two people really influenced my development more than anything. One was a guy called Peter Kelvin, who was a psychologist at University College London, a social psychologist. I had actually started in medicine and then moved over to psychology and wasn't really planning on doing an awful lot of work or getting involved too much. But he really stimulated my interest in the subject, and he also made me think I might be quite good at it. If it weren't for him, I think, you know, heaven knows what I might have been doing, but it probably wouldn't be psychology. And then after I finished my PhD, I went to work at the Institute of Psychiatry, and my boss there was a guy called Michael Russell. And Michael Russell was one of the founding fathers, probably the founding father, of behavioral research in smoking cessation, and hugely influential. And a whole stable of his protégés are now working in the field. and have made a big influence. And what he did, he was a real visionary, but what he did, I think, was brought a level of rigor and scientific rigor to the work, and certainly to my work, that I think wasn't, to be fair, quite there beforehand.
Mm-hmm. And getting sort of more into the smoking cessation, how do you think we're getting on now with our smoking figures, our way that we're addressing smokers? Because it's, for me, it's getting much harder now because there's less of them, but there's still plenty of smokers.
You've got to sort of see it from different sort of perspectives. If you look globally, we're not doing very well.
Right.
Globally, although tobacco smoking prevalence or tobacco use prevalence is coming down a bit, the revenues for the tobacco industry have never been higher. They are doing really well. So people who are currently talking about an end game smoking cessation, you probably heard that. Mm-hmm. The tobacco industries are laughing in our faces. I mean, they are doing incredibly well. They're incredibly profitable still, one of the most profitable sectors. Mm-hmm. And we're not anywhere close to eliminating tobacco from society, and it is a massive scourge. So globally, not so good. However, as you say, in some countries, UK is one, mm-hmm. New Zealand is another, Canada, Australia, certain countries, we are seeing a reduction in smoking prevalence. And actually, there are many parts of the world that have low smoking prevalence, have always had low smoking prevalence. In the UK and Ireland, we are making progress, but we're still looking at smoking prevalence in the teens, sort of around 14-15%. And at that level, we're still looking at, in the UK, for example, at around 60,000 deaths a year from smoking. So, it still would put it, way out there in terms of the avoidable deaths. So we've got an awful long way to go. And my concern right now is with the government that the UK has, and I guess, everyone will have their opinions about what kind of a mess they're making of things, but and what their motivations are. But I see absolutely no appetite or interest whatsoever in doing anything serious about smoking in the UK. The devolved governments, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, there is more interest. But of course, there is relatively little they can do if the Westminster government is not, doing its bit. So, we're seeing smoking prevalence probably plateauing right now, and unless we do something about it, it's still going to be, a major issue. So, lots of work to do, and particularly, again, for people working in the field of smoking cessation, you'll be only too well aware of this. It is very much something that is concentrated among people who are more disadvantaged, whether it's poverty, living conditions, mental health issues, and so on. But people who've got lots of other issues that they have to face are really not being supported. Well, they're sort of being left behind, if you like.
I'm going to talk a wee bit about your book, The Smoke-Free Formula. I read it, and I have to say, Robert, it's one of the best, if not the best, in its field. It's brilliant. But is there... Is there any, with medication to try and help smokers quit, we here in Northern Ireland, we're very limited to what medicines we have, and it really boils down to nicotine replacement. That's it. Is there anything that you know of coming on the market, or any new developments, or what else we could use with support to help our smokers quit.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for your comments about the smoke-free formula. I wrote it with my son, Jamie West, and a guy, Chris Smythe, who was the health correspondent for the Times newspaper at that point. I think he's now political correspondent. Mm-hmm. And it was great fun to write because it allowed me to... the great thing about writing a trade book like that, as opposed to an academic book, is you don't get referees telling you what to say. You can say pretty much what you like. Mm-hmm. And so it was an opportunity to sort of take a really thorough look at all the different ways that people have talked about, but everything from hypnotherapy through to e-cigarettes, nicotine replacement, breathing exercises, physical exercise, everything that people have tried as ways of helping people stop smoking, and to provide readers with a kind of star rating, if you like, as to what the evidence base is for them. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of stuff that has got quite good evidence for it that we don't really shout about that much, but is actually potentially quite useful that, when you add it all together. So, for example, things like breathing exercises, mm-hmm. or even relatively... low levels of physical exercise, just walking or even just doing it while you're sitting in a chair. Mm-hmm. Loads of things like that, things like the way that you sort of mental things, like that your mindset, the way becoming, taking on the identity mm-hmm. of an ex-smoker. This seems to be really important to help protect people from going back to smoking. So things like that. But on the issue of the medications, my go-to medicine will be, when it becomes properly available in the UK, will be one called Cytisine, which is C-Y-T-I-S-I-N-E, as opposed to O-N-E, which is what Word Spell Checker will try and force mm-hmm. you to say. Cytisine is a plant alkaloid which comes from laburnum plants as well as many other plants. And it looks a little bit like nicotine, and there's now, really strong evidence that it is probably at least as good as nicotine replacement therapy, probably better. It is, in my opinion, mm-hmm. Probably about as good as drugs like Champix that we've had on the market, which unfortunately we don't at the moment because it was taken off the market. Mm-hmm. The big thing that Cytisine has going for it, though, apart from the fact that it is effective, is that it's cheap.
Yeah.
So a course of treatment, we did a clinical trial about 10 years ago, just over 10 years ago, and at that time, a course of treatment was equivalent to about £3. Mm-hmm. Full course of treatment, for the mm-hmm. whole lot. It's now much more, but it could become less again because it's out of patent. It's a generic drug. Mm-hmm. And it's so what we have here is this drug has actually been around. It was the very first ever stop smoking drug that was discovered. But it was discovered in Bulgaria, and it's made in Bulgaria, or was. And so, of course, the West didn't know about it. And when we did hear about it, some of us, all of us pretty well, were sceptical about whether it was effective or not. So it never really... took hold, but it's actually really popular in places like Poland, where mm-hmm. you can just buy it over the counter. So I think the sort of phrase I would term for this drug is the aspirin of smoking cessation. It could become incredibly cheap, available from any supermarket or chemist, and we know that it's safe. I mean, millions upon millions of people have taken this drug over the years in Central and Eastern Europe, particularly, but now it's available in Canada, New Zealand, loads of other countries as well. And it is actually the Medicines and Health Regulatory Authority, MHRA, mm-hmm. in the UK, have actually licensed a form of it in the UK, but it's not yet available. And I'm hoping, really, that the company that produces it, Polish company, will start to market it in the UK very soon. And it will... be tremendously helpful, and I think probably give a real shot in the arm for smokers clinics and people who are trying to help smokers to stop.
Yeah, that is in your book. You do talk about that in the smoke-free formula. Mm. Yep. Mm. So I look forward to that hopefully being another tool in the box for smoking cessation advisors to help out. But now moving on and taking a slightly different tact about men. What I'm interested in is, Robert, how do you look after yourself? What do you do to stay mentally fit and healthy and physically fit and healthy? And what advice would you give to others?
Yeah. That's a nice question. I do yoga most mornings with my wife and colleague. We actually do yoga with Adrienne, which I'm sure many of your listeners will have come across, because she seems to be incredibly popular. And they're nice short sessions, sort of between 20 minutes and half an hour, and really good to sort of set you up for the morning. And she's very kooky and seems to be a really nice person. And so she doesn't take it too seriously. And it's a really great start to the day. I actually also do go to the gym. I used to run, but my knees are too much squash and tennis over the years has made my knees quite sore. So running is not so much fun now. So I used to go on the cross trainer in the gym and do the equivalent of about a 4 or 5 mile run, depending on the day, on the cross trainer and do weights and so on. So it is actually very important to me. Being fit and healthy, particularly as one gets older, is an important part of my identity. And I think we know that it also helps with your mental health and keeps you sort of with a sense of perspective and so on. So I play tennis for fun, which I really enjoy, although it's bad for my knees. I don't play squash. I hardly play squash at all now because it's just too bad for my knees, but I do enjoy it when I play. It's one of those things where you don't do it because it's good for you. You do it because you enjoy it despite it not being too good. But those are sorts of things. But my sort of main non-exercise related hobby is playing guitar. I really enjoy that.
Oh, brilliant. Well, here's a story. I remember years ago, I got a job in the health service, and this was a girl, a dentist I was working with, and I got to know her over a period of weeks and months, and she said, "You want to have a game of squash?" And I thought, "Oh yeah, no problem. I'll give her a good hiding." And little did I know, she played for Ulster, and Robert, I didn't get a point. I didn't get a point. And the next day, I could hardly walk. My back was sore. My hamstrings were sore. My groin was sore. I was rolling about. But that was a lesson learned. Never. I'll never forget it.
Squash is really funnily enough, it's a very relaxing game, despite being, incredibly active, or because of being incredibly active, because you can't think about anything else while you're playing. You just got to, it is all-encompassing and all-embracing while you're playing, and in that way, it makes a very good relaxation. I find with tennis, I do enjoy it, but I have enough, time while the shots being made to think about other things, so it's not quite so engrossing.
Yeah. Very good. You brought me back years there. But here, now moving on. I'm going to ask you this next question, but I think I might know the answer or a part of the answer in a more lighthearted way. What is your dream job, or what would your dream job be?
I don't know if you could guess it. You probably couldn't. My dream job when I was younger was to be a television critic.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it was because I like watching television, and the idea of getting paid to watch television sounds like a really good idea. I could still do that. I think I'd be quite a good one, actually, except that I I don't like saying nasty things about people or things, so I'd probably only be able to be a television critic for things that I liked and that were good. So I probably wouldn't be a very successful one. But failing that, I mean, you know, actually being an academic is almost like the dream job. It certainly was when I started out. It was intellectually stimulating. It was, you know, you could work very long hours. I've always worked long hours, but it's not really work. You know, it's not like working, you know, down a mine or whatever. Yeah. You know, it's not physical work. It's intellectually stimulating. You get very rewarded for it. I think it's tougher now for younger academics coming through because there's much more job insecurity. There's far less academic freedom. You know, when I started out, I could just research literally anything I want. I did research in psychology of music, into artificial intelligence, in road traffic accidents, in smoking. You know, anything I felt like I could do research in. And that's, you know, I think, really important part of academic life. But now, obviously, things are much more constrained and the career paths are much more sort of channeled and focused. And if you know, the idea that you could, you know, be a smoking researcher and then start doing traffic accident research just can't really, I don't think, happen anymore because you don't, you know, you've been channeled so far into one area. That's all you really know about. And you wouldn't have the credibility. So being an academic is an unbelievably good job. It's not quite as unbelievably good as it was when I started.
And I would have had you down as maybe playing in a band. That was my guess for you.
What was it? Say again.
Playing in a band, being the lead guitarist of a band.
Oh, playing in a band. Yeah. Well, you know, I did have sort of dreams. I have to confess, actually, that I did, when I went up to university, my plan was to become a jazz guitarist. I realized fairly soon that I didn't have the talent or the application. I might have been able to become a rock guitarist, but being a jazz guitarist is a whole different thing. You know, the level of skill and understanding of you know, music theory and so on that you need to be a good one, I would have had to work a lot harder than I was prepared to. And also, of course, you know, the irony is that as a jazz guitarist, it's not. You're very unlikely to get very well paid for it. And so I wouldn't be able to afford all the guitars that I now have if I'd actually been a guitarist.
Very good, yeah. So what makes you happy now, Robert? Where do you get your fun from, or your contentment or happiness, or where does that come from?
Yeah, I get loads of things, really. I'm certainly playing guitar. I love music and recording and so on. That's really good fun. I do actually like to watch YouTube videos and Netflix, but YouTube videos I've become quite a fan of for learning about various things like aviation, for example. Aviation videos are very interesting, not least what they tell you about psychology. There's some terrific channels out there. There's one called Mentor Pilot. A tip for any of your listeners. The guy really takes you through some fascinating aviation stories, air accident investigations, but other things as well. YouTube videos, of that sort, physics videos I like as well.
Right, okay.
And funnily enough, actually, I like on going virtual walking tours of super yachts. That's quite interesting. Susan and I, do cryptic crosswords every day, which is fun. Keeps the brain ticking over, and enjoy that. I like to eat. I love food.
Lovely.
And I like just, you know, hanging out. Really, to be honest, it's a great thing about being retired. Is that although I still do work quite a lot, I guess probably do about 30 hours a week or something like that. That's still plenty of time to just sit and stare into space or walk or, you know, just do fun stuff. So yeah, it's there's lots of great stuff to do.
Well, Robert, that's been a brilliant half hour having a chat with you. Thank you for agreeing to do our Belfast Mental Health Group podcast. It's really been really brilliant. Brilliant talking to you. And my final question is, do you have anybody for our next podcast? Who do you think would be good? And we'll do our best to get them.
It's been a great pleasure for me. Thanks very much for having me on. Who would be a good...
You can email me.
The person I've been very, very lucky in my life. I'm not being modest here. Genuinely, a lot of it is luck.
Yeah.
One of the lucky things that I had was taking on a young researcher, Jamie Brown, who is now Professor Jamie Brown at UCL, and he runs the smoking cessation team at UCL, and I think he'd be a terrific person to find out more about.
UCL. Perfect. I'll check him out. Robert, it's been a pleasure.
Lovely.
And thank you.
Likewise. And,
okay.
Thanks very much for having me on.
And thanks very much.